Good evening and welcome to Commonwealth FM's live discussion dialogue. Tonight's topic is the new American Empire. And with me here to talk it through are ex-naval intelligence veteran Kenyon Gibson, former Bosnia aid worker and spokesperson for Bristol Stop the War, that's Martin Summers, and also Dr. Chris Burns Cox, who's just come back from Palestine 2 weeks ago. First of all, I'm Tony Gosling, by the way. First of all, you, Kenyon, when did you move here from the United States and why?
I came here in 1990. I wouldn't really say I moved here, but I visit here quite often, going back to about 1990. I'm also very glad to be here. I just love this country, though I'm from the States. I think what's going on in the States is terribly wrong. A lot of you may have known that Sir Elton John came out with his own anti-Bush remarks this week. I think he's spot on. So I'm very happy to spend time outside of the United States, and I see people here are taking the right stance. In World War II, it was against Hitler. Right now, Bush is starting war throughout the world. Unfortunately, he's dragged in a lot of he's dragged the British troops into it, but actually most British people are not for this war, and the British troops are rightfully questioning what they're doing in Iraq. They don't like the antics of the American troops, and they're not for the American government. So I just want to say that I really respect that, and I respect Britain.
Thanks, Kenyon. Now on to you, Chris. You have just come back literally 2 weeks ago from Palestine, and you're a doctor that may have treated many people in the Bristol area, particularly at French Hay Hospital, a consultant physician for 30 years up there. What made you decide to actually go and visit Palestine?
Well, for many years, I've gradually become increasingly depressed by... You see, I was brought up to think that basically we were a fairly sound moral nation, and that although the empire was, most of it, glorious, even winning in Malaya, killing the Mau Mau, these were honourable tasks to help develop poorer, less developed nations. I was brought
up
with
that view.
I'm sure some
would disagree with that. But
over the last few years, I've come to realise, the last 20 years gradually, it's getting more and more deeply ingrained in my mind that our colonial history is absolutely appalling and the disasters we've left behind. So I have a guilt feeling about some of the places where we've been, where we've made an absolute mess. And that's partly why I went to Iraq 3 years ago, why I went to Palestine for the third time 2 or 3 weeks ago, to find out just how awful it is, that I can come back and then actually say, I've seen the war, I've seen demolished buildings, I've seen families who've been turned out of their homes, I've talked with them.
And on to you, Martin. What made you get involved with the Bristol Stop the War group?
Well, I mean, in many respects, like many people in this country, I've been very shocked and horrified about the way the world has gone since the September the 11th attacks and the attitudes of the American regime towards the rest of the world. And I'm not the only person involved in Bristol Stop the War. We've been one of the most active cities in the country. We took nearly 70 buses to the February the 15th demonstration. We could have taken a lot more, except we couldn't find any more buses. Bristol is full of people who agree with me.
But it's not just the US, is it? The UK is involved as well.
Yes, shamefully so. I think it's not in our national interest. I think that's quite clear. At one stage, the British ambassador to Saudi Arabia was asked on Newsnight, is it true that no British ambassador in the Middle East agrees with Blair's war policy? And he said, no comment. I think that says it all. In actual fact, the diplomatic establishment in this country have been horrified by the way in which Blair has just gone along with this American war game.
Well, that's a short introduction from our three guests. We as you've heard from them, they're all people who are against, really, the foreign policy of the UK and the US at the moment in the Middle East and in Afghanistan, etc. We were going to be joined by a representative from the US Embassy to explain the United States position under a bit of cross-examination from us, and really to put their point of view. But citing the embassy's belief that the conversation this evening would not be a rational one with the guests we have here, they declined. Instead, they sent me a statement, which they faxed through to me, which I'll read out now. It's a quote from President Bush's speech in November 2003 when he came to London. And it puts the official US Embassy's point of view, and it'd be interesting to get comments from the three of you here on what they have to say. The deepest beliefs of our nations set the direction of our foreign policy. We value our own civil rights, so we stand for the human rights of others. We affirm the God-given dignity of every person, so we are moved to action by poverty and oppression and famine and disease. The United States and Great Britain share a mission in the world beyond the balance of power or the simple pursuit of interest. We seek the advance of freedom and the peace that freedom brings, they say. Together, our nations are standing and sacrificing for this high goal in the distant land at this very hour. And America honours the idealism and the bravery of the sons and daughters of Britain. We have great objectives before us that make our Atlantic Alliance as vital as it has ever been. We will encourage the strength and effectiveness of international institutions. And finally, we will use force where necessary in the defence of freedom, and we will raise up an ideal of democracy in every part of the world. So that's what the US Embassy had to say, is their contribution to this evening's discussion. Any comments?
Well, all I can say is that hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. Those sentiments, insofar as I agree with them, and most of them are unexceptional, democracy, freedom, these are words. In reality, I just came back from Colombia in June, where the US-backed regime kills 7,000 of its political opponents every year. That's the kind of democracy which America actually practices, rather than the sort of thing that it preaches in statements like that.
Coming
from the US, I'm not surprised, but I completely agree with Martin. It's a line of nonsense.
I would say that the actions of the United States over the last 20 years or so have been totally different to what those very high and wonderful principles speak of. So I would say hypocrisy. Dreadful, depressing hypocrisy.
Okay. Well, they're not here to answer that, unfortunately, but just so that listeners know that they were invited. Let's start at the beginning of this war on terrorism. Which was the September the 11th attacks. The US government still haven't published any evidence linking Osama bin Laden to the four hijackings and the plane crashes at the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. Why not?
Sometimes it's just an obvious answer, isn't it? They've really given us no evidence because there is no evidence. They've certainly spent billions of dollars claiming to look for the evidence. The hunt for bin Laden was what they used as the first excuse for war. We were all going to Afghanistan, we were going to find bin Laden, we were going to stop global terror and spread democracy and do good and justice for all. That turned out to be a line of nonsense. General Tommy Frank spelled it out. He said, "We're not here to find bin Laden." Anybody who's really been looking for bin Laden within the U.S. government has been dissuaded. There was John O'Neill, the FBI director. As soon as he started looking for bin Laden and saying that there were security breaches and that something might happen to the U.S., he was put out of the way. Tragically, he died on September 11th after he had just been appointed to a post in the World Trade Centers.
So this is the guy who was supposed to be looking for bin Laden?
Yes, well, he was one of the American agents in FBI, well, an FBI director, who said that it was in America's interest to find bin Laden and that they had to. A defense intelligence agent was given similar bad treatment. Her name is Julie Sears. She was a very gifted defense intelligence agent, a graduate of Georgetown University. She studied the languages and customs of the region and was quite adept at getting into Afghanistan, dressed in native tribal dress. So she was able to accomplish a lot, and she was given a lot of flack. And then she, after the embassy bombing in Africa, where she really wanted to get bin Laden, now this man had killed several of her fellow citizens. You know, this was her heart's desire to put an end to this. She grudgingly got permission to spend her two-week holiday in Afghanistan, where she was able to meet the leader of the Northern Alliance, Mamoum. I don't remember his exact name. I apologize for that. But at any rate, he was the leader of the Northern Alliance, and he was able to give her a lot of information about getting bin Laden. She came back to the United States with that, very, very triumphant in her own heart. And the first thing they did was take away her badge, lock her out of the building, confiscate her evidence, and then threaten her with prison time if she spoke out. It just seems that the search for bin Laden is a bunch of nonsense. Many people have tipped off the FBI and the CIA about bin Laden, including British tourists, Cindy and Mike Thompson, and they were just told to get lost. So bin Laden is what Mr. Orwell would call an Emmanuel Goldstein. He exists, and because he exists, the United States can spend billions of dollars and go to war wherever it wants, and it does seem that the United States created bin Laden. They certainly funded him. He certainly was a CIA operative at one point, and now the evidence shows clearly that they have no interest in getting bin Laden.
Martin, I could see you nodding there when we were talking about this FBI guy, John O'Neill.
Yeah. Well, John O'Neill was an honest cop, and of course, honest cops are not necessarily very popular. And I think what's happening now with Porter Goss's rule in the CIA, as Kenyon will confirm, is that lots of people are being sacked now as we speak because they didn't come out with the right line over the Iraq war. So they really just... What is going on here is the criminalisation of the law enforcement structure. The French Secret Service gave an off-the-record interview to Le Figaro on November the 1st, 2001, where they said, well, the CIA representative in Dubai met with bin Laden in the American hospital in Dubai on July the 4th, 2001. And they said, we followed them to the meeting and we saw that they'd had this meeting. Now, regardless of the truth or untruth of that, and it was reported also in the Newsnight and in The Guardian, the point that I would make there is that either the French are lying about the fact that they met with bin Laden, or the Americans are lying. The Americans denied it, of course. I tend to believe the French.
And the other thing which seems to have disappeared out of off the top priority lists of the people who are chasing the terrorists is the anthrax. I remember at the time, just after September the 11th, there were several anthrax attacks around the United States, people just opening envelopes full of anthrax. And then we heard nothing more about where this anthrax came from.
Well, it came from Fort Derrick in Maryland. We all know where it came from because it was traced back to Fort Derrick in Maryland, which National Weapons Laboratory.
Now, how can that be proven?
Weaponized anthrax can be traced. You know, it's got a signature that can be traced, and it definitely came from Fort Derrick. The question is how whoever got hold of it got hold of it. Yeah. How did bin Laden's people get into Fort Derrick?
That was the genetic fingerprint of it. That research was conducted by many doctors, including Dr. Leonard Horowitz of the United States. The anthrax was a major hoax. The purpose of it was to close the Senate during discussion of the Patriot Bill and to close later the Supreme Court after President Bush signed the Patriot Bill so that the Supreme Court could not overrule him because it was, in fact, an unconstitutional act.
We should remember that four people died as a result of this.
Five, actually.
Five, okay.
This is what you seem to be saying is that, and you just yourself then said, Martin, is the criminalisation of the law enforcement process. What are the implications of that?
Well, pretty horrific. I think, as I said earlier, I was in Colombia in June, and what you have there is a narco state supported by the United States. During the 1980s, when the Reagan regime was in power, the Contra War, which, let's remember, it was against a democratically elected government that twice won the elections. It was a terrorist campaign directed mainly against civilians, in which 30,000 people died, and it was funded by the transmission of cocaine into the United States, and the proceeds from the sales of the cocaine were used to fund the Contra. And this was all uncovered by Senator Kerry's committee that investigated the affair. But of course, strangely enough, Senator Kerry did not use any of the information that he gathered in that investigation in the recent election. And people sort of know that there was an Iran-Contra affair, and they sort of know that what happened happened, but then somehow, I don't know how it's done, it's the way the mainstream media works, somehow it's all forgotten about. All that stuff about the cocaine, it's all on the record.
The September the 11th attacks, if they weren't carried out by Bin Laden, or, you know, it does seem that there is a complete yawning gap of evidence between the attacks themselves and Bin Laden. What was behind them, and who did carry them out? Any ideas?
I think two things stand out here. You might think it sensible that the people who carried out the attacks are the people who planned the attacks. In that case, that's the U.S. government. In 1961, they had these sort of attacks drawn up. They called it Operation Northwoods. They were willing to kill both American civilians and American soldiers so that they could claim that Cuba had attacked them. They were also very, very clever in this. They were going to take Cubans and make Cuban terrorists, so there would actually be Cuban terrorists. They would give the Cuban terrorists grenades to throw at the soldiers on the Guantanamo Bay naval base in Cuba.
Yeah, but that was 1961, Kenyon. Now we're, you know, this is 2001. It's 40 years different.
2004.
But September 11th happened in 2001. You know, this is 40 years ago.
That's true, but the people who were the stewards of that plan are still around. It was drawn up by General Lyman L. Lemnitzer, the other four Joint Chiefs of Staff, and President Eisenhower at that time. A senator named Prescott Samuel Bush was also involved in that. He was Eisenhower's favorite golfing partner. That plan was then made top secret. It was sealed for 40 years. It's only been revealed lately to the public by James Bamford in his book Body of Secrets. A lot of people knew about that plan, even the former ambassador to the UK, Robert Strange McNamara. He was the one who presented it to Kennedy. So they didn't just forget about that plan.
Some people say that when you talk about the US government involvement in this, that there'd be so many people who would know that you would never keep it a secret. And in fact, they haven't kept it a secret. I mean, people do know. We know, but it doesn't make any difference that we know. That's one of the problems.
People within the United States government, for instance, Colonel Don de Grand Pré knows, and Colonel Don de Grand Pré has actually written three books about this, and he says straight out that it was done by the U.S. government. He says that many veterans and people inside the Pentagon know that it's Bush. He says that it's possible we may even see a coup in the United States because the U.S. military, those who are honest military personnel, are sick of the nonsense and will have no choice but to storm the White House. That's what an American colonel has said, and this American colonel, by the way, was a Pentagon advisor and arms dealer to the Middle East, so he does know a lot about what he's talking, and he's also written some very precise papers about the airplanes themselves, and he says that those airplanes were definitely remotely controlled.
Well, that's a pretty strong allegation that there may possibly be a military coup in the United States, but as we've heard from Martin earlier on, there is this kind of division within the American military establishment. And you were saying, Martin, that the new head of the CIA is removing people who aren't sympathetic with the official
That's
views.
That's right. I mean, why we know what we do know, the things we've been saying, is because honest public officials, whether policemen or military, have let us know. Otherwise, we wouldn't know, would we? And I think that there's a struggle goes on at the top between people who are honest and want to do a proper job and others who are basically criminals. And 'twas ever thus. Organised crime is organised, and there's a continuous struggle to keep it down. But I'm afraid in recent years and decades in the United States, we've lost that fight.
Chris, I'd like to come back to you. Can you tell us a bit about your experiences when you were over in Palestine? Because obviously the struggle there is kind of related. Israel is very much a US-backed state in the Middle East.
You sometimes wonder if the tail is the United States and the dog is Israel, in the way that Bush will say whatever Sharon tells him to say.
Is it not the other way around?
On the surface, because Israel's a small place and the United States is vast, but one suspects that the United States responds to what Mr. Sharon wants. He gets what he wants. He's got what he wants, you know, for a very long time. So what was the experience like? Well, basically, one knew, and I've been reading about this and been there before, you knew it was going to be horrible and very, very negative in the facts on the ground. That is, the wall surrounding towns with only one gate, and the Israeli so-called defence force can open and shut it whenever they want. They don't have to give reasons. So you could have a town of 30,000 people or 50,000 people just locked in.
Well, they would say, of course, the Israelis would say that that's done for security purposes to make sure that there are, if they have intelligence of some sort, that the suicide lines, bombers may be in there.
But the actual delineation of the wall is not separating Israelis from Palestinians. It's separating, to a large extent, Palestinians from Palestinians. In other words, it's Palestinians both sides of the wall. So it rather makes that contention, the suggestion that it's for security, it rather says that it's not exactly that. It's really for stealing more land and getting as much land as they can with as few Palestinians as possible. But its effect is just absolutely so cruel. It's appalling.
You obviously met people over there who were being affected by this. Can you
yes.
just give us a picture of a sort of ordinary Palestinian household and how they have to cope with this?
Yeah, well, firstly, they can't get to work, whether it's in their own fields, whether it's their family been farming for hundreds of years, or they can't get to Jerusalem or wherever the town is that they were working. They just cannot get there. And secondly, if where they're ill, they have to spend hours trying to get help. They're separated from the hospital by the wall. They're separated from their schools by the wall. The Palestinian University at Al-Quds is having an enormous struggle to survive because the undergraduates just cannot get there. So that's part of it. So the unemployment, because there's virtually no work, is vast. Now, for a young Arab man to be unemployed and not able to support his family, because the pride and the energy and the determination of those Palestinians is absolutely wonderful to behold. That is the one uplifting thing about the situation, is what a wonderful spirit the Palestinian people are showing. It's so terrific, this pride. The frustration is so awful that it's not surprising that they say, is life worth living? You know, I must do something. If the only way I can achieve what I see as honour is by doing something terrible, then, as a number of people, including our current Prime Minister's wife, said, it's understandable why they should behave like that. And as long as the occupation goes on, it will continue in some form or another of violence against the Israelis. I'm afraid to say it's terribly sad, but occupation, occupation, occupation. That's the basic problem.
Now, as a medical doctor of a long-standing practice in Bristol, what was your experience of the medical facilities out there? Obviously, people get ill, people get injured. What sort of medical facilities were
there?
The
total sort of public health situation is that infant number of babies per 1,000 births dying has gone up enormously from 50 to over 100 per 1,000 live births. So that's a sort of common statistic. Maternal mortality in the mothers dying in childbirth amongst the Palestinians is many times higher than it is amongst the Israelis, many times higher. They are considerably deprived, and they've got special problems in that they've got vast numbers of disabled people who've lost arms and legs and bits of their brain and their eyes and this sort of thing as a result of the Intifada and what the Israelis have done. So there's a vast need for extra. There's a vast need for extra psychiatry. One has to say that there are some very honourable Israeli medical people, and Physicians for Human Rights Israel is an example of that. And they actually do help Palestinians who need high-tech care to get through the roadblocks and whatever to get to a really good quality hospital in Israel. And a number of the doctors in Israel will treat these Palestinians free. So there are good people in Israel. There's no doubt about it. There are a number of very good Israeli people, and they're doing the best they can. But I'm afraid to say that there are a lot who don't, who have a terrible hatred and totally despise all Palestinians.
Well, I think that's the sort of situation you'd expect when there's a big conflict like that going on, is a lot of hatred being brewed up. But of course, the Israelis would say that they have to take these extreme measures because of the wave of suicide bombers that there have been in Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities.
Well, they are actually pinpricks in comparison with the suffering and the shooting up of the Palestinians. I mean, the number is actually so much smaller that really you can't compare it. I mean, the one is slaughter and the other is an occasional ghastly event.
Now, I'd like to bring the Martin and Kenyon in again. How do you both feel that the situation in Israel and Palestine relates to the wider war on terror being waged by the US primarily, but now also the UK?
Shall I go? I think that the Israelis do have a great deal of influence in Washington. That's pretty clear, to the extent that they are a tail wagging the dog to some extent, although it's a dog that wants to be wagged as well. It's not just a manipulation by the Israelis. But in relating to September the 11th earlier, the Bergen Record, which is a newspaper for New York local newspaper, from the area of New York across the river from the Twin Towers, they reported on the day of the attack that there was a white van in the park with some men standing on the roof of the van videoing the first plane when it crashed into the World Trade Center. This was noticed by a passerby who reported it to the local police, who then arrested the men in the white van some hours later because they actually gave them the number of the van. It turned out that they had thousands of dollars in cash on them, box cutters, plans of the World Trade Center, and it turned out that they were all Israeli agents. Now, I'm not saying that the Israelis carried out the attack. I'm just saying that the kind of people, that this is a kind of joint operation between pro-Israeli elements within the US security forces and Mossad. And Mossad pride themselves on this kind of thing, although they don't suppose they'll pride themselves on getting caught on this occasion.
So, what about you, Kenyon? What do you think?
Yeah, that was funny how that was scrubbed. That was a very important article. American citizens who were eyewitnesses to something suspicious there did the right thing, reported it, and then nobody wants to hear about it. A follow-up on that story is that those five dancing men who were expressing such joy when the towers went down, and you might notice a bit of anger in my voice. I'm actually from New York. As a child, I watched the towers go up, and I had a lot of people who I had a friend who was scheduled to talk at the towers, but at the last minute he didn't. I didn't lose anyone there. I know people who have, and it galls me that five people can sit there on the rooftop in New Jersey dancing while the towers got destroyed. They obviously had something to do with it. Those five people now are back in Israel. The United States government just let them go back to Israel. Mm-hmm. I had a few moments ago said that the United States government was behind 9/11. I completely believe so. Most evidence points to it. There is a lot of evidence, such as this, that points to some amount of complicity from Mossad.
Now, you wrote a book, didn't you, about some of the suspicions around 9/11, Kenyon. Can you tell us about what the title is and roughly, you know, what your main conclusion was?
The title that I chose was Common Sense, A Study of the Bushes, the CIA, and the Suspicions Regarding 9/11, as it has been translated into Arabic, and I'm not exactly sure how they translated the title. I don't know, and I can't pronounce it, so I won't try. But it's about all the suspicions about 9/11, and it goes through categorically, point by point, the reasons why there should be suspicion about 9/11, including a gigantic press cover-up, and as we've been discussing, the aftermath to 9/11, the cui bono.
You talk about a gigantic press cover-up, but you know, I was watching my TV on September 11th, 2001, and I saw a massive amount of coverage. As far as I'm concerned, there was no cover-up.
Oh, well, you can't cover up the fact that two buildings just got destroyed. The press was right there. That was the big story of the day. You stop what you're doing and you send some reporters down to cover the story of the century, of course. I'm talking about a cover-up of the investigation. I'm not saying the press wasn't there. They were there. In fact, suspiciously, some were there before the event. There's been a cover-up of the fact that there is a plethora of evidence that leads to this being an inside U.S. government job, and getting back to the angle of who benefits, which is Israel, which is the United States, we should be looking in the direction and we should be asking who benefits. We should be asking who traded those stocks before 9/11 with insider knowledge of the attacks that were going to happen. It's been proven that bin Laden did not do it. There was a Times article about a month after 9/11 that showed that bin Laden did not do it. And then the evidence started to point to Buddy Krongard of Deutsche Bank, who had connections to the CIA. The press doesn't report this. The press, the mainstream press, has categorically avoided this whole issue.
Which I think requires some kind of institutional explanation. I think, you know, when you think about who owns the press, that starts to give you some clues. The Rupert Murdochs and Conrad Blacks and so on. You know, if you work for one of these organisations and you start talking about things like this, your feet ain't going to touch the floor and you certainly ain't going to get promoted. And that makes a big difference in creating this atmosphere of silence and complicity.
Well, the CIA openly boasts that it owns all the journalists in the United States. And a lot of this news on 9/11 came from the Washington Times. That's called America's paper. I don't know that anybody sensible would believe it, but unfortunately it has a lot of clout in Washington. The man who owns it is very close to Bush. The man who owns it is the Reverend Sun Myung Moon. He's the leader of the Unification Church. Some people call it the Moonies. Most Christian churches regard it as a heresy, and that's just something that the UK and many other countries would not allow in because it damages people who get involved in it. Mr. Moon started his career early in jail in North Korea. He went to South Korea. He spent more time in jail. That was for sex offenses. Then he spent time in jail in the United States. Yet he's been able to spend 40 years in the United States, and he's been able to buy up the Washington Times in 1982. He's also been able to buy up UPI, and he's been able to buy up Tiempos del Mundo, which he got into in South America. So I'll stop here because I could really go on for a long time with this, but let's just say the press in the United States is owned by some really dodgy characters, and they've been caught a number of times printing lies, including the false pictures of British troops that award-winning photographer Brian Walsky put in the LA Times. They were meant to incite tensions and to incite Iraqis. They were completely false photographs. He had doctored the photographs themselves. The LA Times had to fire him for this, but this just goes to show the United States will print total lies in their papers, and if they don't like the truth, no one's forcing them to print it.
You're listening to Dialogue on 87.7 Commonwealth FM, broadcasting across the city of Bristol. We're discussing the new American empire tonight. In a moment, I'll be moving on with my guests to consider Britain's role in the new American empire and where the US and British troops may be targeting next. Before that, here's a flashback to February 1968. The issue was Vietnam and the artists Country Joe and the Fish.
Give me an F!
Yeah!
Give me an I!
I!
Give me an S!
Yes!
Give me an
H!
What's that spell?
Fish!
What's that spell?
Fish!
What's that spell?
Fish!
Yeah, come on, all you big strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. He's got himself in a terrible jam. Way down yonder in Vietnam. So put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. My, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Well, come on, General, let's move fast. The old big chance has come at last. Gotta go out, get those reds. The only good commie is one that's dead. And you know that peace could only be won when the golden ball the kingdom come. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
Whoa.
dropping on the Viet Cong. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next up is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
Well, come on, brothers, throughout the land, pack your boys up to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, don't hesitate, send them off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box.
And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
That's Country Joe and the Fish there, from 1968. Now, the question we're dealing with this evening is the new American Empire. And the big question, I think, that everyone is wondering is, why are the British involved in all this? Back in the late 60s, the Vietnam conflict, the Americans approached the British to go along to Vietnam to help them out in Vietnam. And Harold Wilson, who was the Labour Prime Minister at the time, said, no, thank you. Why this time has Tony Blair decided that, yes, it's a good idea for the British military to be involved in Iraq?
Well, as you rightly say, Harold Wilson kept Britain out of the Vietnam War, unlike the Australians and the New Zealanders, who've got their own memorials to the useless sacrifice. We, sensibly enough, have not got memorials to useless sacrifice in Vietnam, because Wilson correctly understood that the British population would not stand for hundreds or thousands of deaths about nothing, which we, you know, a war in which we had no interest. But of course, what Blair will be aware of, because he's not a stupid man, is that what happened to Wilson subsequently was that James Jesus Angleton, who was head of CIA counterintelligence, picked up his scrambler telephone, phoned his colleagues in MI6, and said, "Well, you do realise that Wilson's working for the Russians, don't you?" And which, of course, allowed them to, because they'd now been cleared by the CIA to do it, to start persecuting Wilson, following him around, tapping his telephone, trying to find scandal on him, and so on and so forth, which Wilson was aware, and he did complain to various journalists about this. But he was dismissed as a kook and somebody going crazy, and he did, in fact, in the end, go quite senile. But if people remember that era, one minute he was Prime Minister and then suddenly he resigned and Callaghan came in, who was a much more safe pair of hands. And let's face it, nobody's allowed to rule Britain who is going to be crossing the United States. I mean, we are like Poland in relation to the Soviet Union between 1945 and 1989. And that's the reality of our position. And what Blair, and I saw Blair speak in Bristol as a member of the Labour Party, and he was speaking to us all in the council house, and he said, "What you've got to understand is that America is a democracy, and I know there are problems with them, but if we do anything to damage the special relationship," he said, "this party will be destroyed." Those were his exact words. This was a veiled threat.
So what, I mean, how on earth could the Americans destroy the Labour Party? It just seemed like an empty threat.
Oh, you can destroy parties, you cut off their funding, you find scandal on their key figures, you tap their telephones. Everybody's got skeletons in the cupboard, you can find them.
Or you implement the tactics that are outlined in what's called strategies for maintaining U.S. objectives within the U.K. That's a very secret document, not many copies of it around. The United States was very unhappy about getting a no from Britain in the Vietnam War. They really wanted to bring Britain into it. Shortly before the Vietnam War, Operation Northwoods had detailed plans to attack Commonwealth countries so that Britain could be brought into a conflict with Cuba and then possibly later Russia. So what Martin is saying makes perfect sense. The Americans went out to destroy Wilson. Now, the Americans draw up contingency plans not only to invade this country, full-scale military invasion, but they have spies working in this country. They have...
Well, I think I can understand that, you know, most countries would have spies, but I think the idea that the Americans have got plans to invade Britain is really almost crazy.
It's all crazy, Tony. I mean, it really is.
The Russians never invaded Poland in the end. They didn't need to. They used their local puppets, and that's the preferred method of any superpower. You don't really want to take the male fist out of the velvet glove unless you have to.
So why is it so important for the United States, the world's biggest superpower, to have Britain over in Iraq, to have them on board?
It's important to the United States because if this country were to go against America, that would make America alone, and it's much harder to act alone. It's not just that, but if Britain were to be against the United States, say Britain and the whole Commonwealth, which is composed of 48 countries, it could seriously hinder American plans. What you want is to bring them in on your side, so you neutralize that contingency. They're not going to be in your way; they're going to be with you. So America has been quite aware of that. They're clever. Yes, it's nuts, Tony, but these guys are clever, and so they've managed to bring Britain in on their side this time. Ironically, many of the Arabs are actually thankful in a way that the British soldiers are there because the atrocities that are committed by the Americans have been toned down by the British, and that's a sore point between the British forces and the American forces. The British forces many times have spoken out against the atrocities and the acts that the Americans have been doing. So there may be a silver lining to this cloud, though I personally am not thankful that America has been able to pull this one over.
Now, the people behind this project in the United States are the neoconservatives, who are have been around for 20 years or so, and a kind of shadowy group sort of behind the scenes up until now, but now they're in power. What is neoconservatism? Who are these neoconservatives? I see that many of them are followers of this chap Leo Strauss at Chicago University. What do people know about the neoconservatives? Where are they coming from? What's their ideology?
Are they all Christian?
They claim to be, although many of them are also practicing Jews.
Yes, and Adolf Hitler went to church too.
Yeah. It's not just about religion, is it? It's an ideology of empire. You know, when Britain had an empire at the end of the 19th century, we had a similar ideology, a belief in our goodness and our destiny and our role in the world and all the rest of it. And frankly, we've never quite given it up, which is why we, you know, this is our bastard child here, doing the same things we used to do, and getting away with it in the same kind of way as we used to.
However, Martin, I think there is a big difference that you perhaps don't understand. I think certainly any empire, the Roman Empire, the Russians, the British, whomever, have made some mistakes. But I think that we're looking at a very different creature here. We're looking at what a lot of people are calling the Fourth Reich. And it's not being run to implement health and education in colonies. It's being run just to destroy the inhabitants of those colonies, take the resources of those colonies, and create war. The ideology behind what America is doing is the ideology of the arms dealers who are really behind the neocons. Forget this stuff about Christianity. Christianity has nothing to do about this. Real Christians are against this very much, and real Christians, again, ignored by the mainstream press, are very much against Bush, including his own cousins.
So, yeah, but George Bush himself is a Christian. He's a fundamentalist Christian born again.
That must be very appealing to a country with a lot of fundamentalist Christians born again, as Hitler's statements about his own Christianity in a Catholic country were very appealing at that time. So, I mean, look, if Bush had been born in Iraq, he'd have been a Muslim. I mean, he's telling us what we want to hear or what they want to hear. Yeah, what he's really doing...
The religious conservatives who are voting for him are voting fodder. They don't know anything about what we're talking about here. They're just wheeled out to as a big block vote.
But I mean, talk about things like the Fourth Reich, you know, and comparing it with Hitler's Third Reich. Isn't that really rather inflammatory talk? There's surely no real connection between Hitler and Bush.
Well, U.S. government record would severely contradict that statement. U.S. government record shows us that Prescott Samuel Bush was instrumental in building up the Nazi empire. They had to confiscate four companies from him. They came and dealt with him in October of 1942. The record is just terrible. He was able to get off because of the power of his lawyer, Alan Dulles, who then started the CIA afterwards. But the Bush-Nazi connection is very strong. Now, I'm not saying that this present Bush is a Nazi, but the family goes back with the Nazis. The families had an interest in supporting the Nazi government so that the Nazis would buy arms from the United States. In fact, the Nazis were in part a creation of the American arms dealers.
And these are the kind of people who accuse people like us of being appeasers. It's an astonishing reversal, isn't it?
No, the appeasers are the people who are letting Bush go into Iraq.
Well, I quite agree.
They're saying this can't get any worse, or he's not really bad.
Blair's position is he sees himself as Churchill, and he is in fact Chamberlain. That's the problem.
Exactly, Martin.
Now, just to bring you in here again, Dr. Chris Burns Cox. We had a lady here in Bristol last week, an American who's spent 15 months out in Iraq. She'd just done a tour of churches in the United States, and she came to do a talk at the Baptist Church here in the city centre. And she was recounting the views of ordinary Iraqis about what the Americans are up to and what the British are up to over there occupying the country. I'm interested just to run these past you to see what you think after your experiences of Iraq. First of all, she said that the forces are there to back up Israel's territorial ambitions. This is what the Iraqis themselves believe, which are apparently between the right-wing Israelis are saying that they want all the land between the River Nile and between the River Nile and the Euphrates, between the two rivers. That's reason number one. Reason number two was that it's purely military, to get 14 military bases, which are already there now in Iraq. And the third one is economic, taking oil and installing American corporations like McDonald's and things like that in Iraq. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I was there during the sanctions before the war, so I don't know what their opinions are now. They didn't think very much about the British when I was there, because after all, it was only the British in the United States that wanted to maintain the economic sanctions, which pauperized the people. Of course, they gave Saddam increasing strength because they removed any opposition. But it pauperized the decent and excellent people of the country. Everything was falling to bits because we'd illegally bombed a lot of it, of course, to start with. So at that time, they hadn't any time for us, basically. And we were bombing them from the air whenever the pilots chose to, very bravely from 28,000 feet, where they're a little bit out of range of a local gun. So, in fact, they hadn't any time for us. But the ordinary human beings, like the group I went with called Voices in the Wilderness, they were delighted to see us. So the fact that we'd bothered to go and take the minimum of risk, but we'd bothered to go and meet them and stayed in their houses and talked to them, meant a great deal to them, just as of the Palestinians. The fact that they're not forgotten, but they hadn't any time for the British government policy at that time.
So even though British jets were flying over them and bombing, they were still quite happy to welcome you into their homes. That
yes,
sounds quite incredible.
Absolutely. I think if you turn up in any Arab, the door of any Arab home, they will welcome you in. You'd have to be a very extraordinarily ghastly person to not be welcomed in. And even if they had a minimum of food, you'd get more than your fair share of it.
Now, things have moved on since you were there, obviously, with the occupation now. And we have other countries occupied by the US forces and the British forces, Afghanistan and Iraq. Where next? Whereabouts? Is there likely to be another occupation in the Middle East area, or will it be some other part of the world?
I think they're looking towards Iran, Syria. That's what it seems to look like to me. I think they have been a bit shocked by the level of resistance in Iraq. I mean, the US Army is now at the limit of what it can achieve operationally without a draft, which they'll probably have to bring in. The Israelis are pushing for an attack on Iran. I don't think the US has got the resources to attack Iran while it's fighting in Iraq, so the Israelis may do that as a freelance operation, some kind of airstrike on Iranian nuclear reactors seems likely. The Iranians have said if that happens, then they will fight back. They will fire missiles at Israel. And, of course, they've got nuclear weapons, so this is all extremely scary.
Now, it's interesting you say they've got nuclear weapons, Martin, because I can remember back in 97, sitting at home watching a documentary on BBC Two, which was a kind of investigative programme, looking at... It was based in the Ukraine, and there was an old nuclear weapons store, which was an ex-Soviet weapons store with one guard on the gate. And the investigative team followed these unmarked trucks from this nuclear weapons store into Iran. So the fact that on the news today we've been hearing that Iran, we've got to stop Iran developing a nuclear program.
Well, when I said they've got nuclear weapons, I meant the Israelis, not the Iranians, which of course they have.
Well, this program that I saw, I mean,
if the Israelis have nuclear weapons, which they do, it would not be unreasonable for the Iranians to have them. That's the reason why we've got nuclear weapons, because they said if we've got to have them, because they've got them, and if we don't have them, we'll be attacked.
So what are you saying? The logic,
it's called deterrence, yeah?
Are you saying everybody should have them?
No, I'm not. But, I mean, perhaps if we started off by disarming Israel, then the Iranians wouldn't feel the need to have them. Yeah?
Quite possibly. So, is it just Iran? Maybe Syria? Anywhere else?
Well, that's enough to be going on with, isn't it? Let's face it.
And you talked about, about the draft, possibility of having the draft in the United States. Do you think that will make a big difference, Kenyon, from your knowledge of America?
Yes, I think they will implement the draft. I think it will make a difference in that you'll see a lot more Americans speaking up. Right now, the Americans are complacent. They're not getting bombed. They're not having to deal with napalm or the recent chemical weapons spraying that went on in Fallujah. They're sitting there pretty much feeling safe. They don't have as many jobs as they used to. But when they start having to sacrifice their kids, who they've been hoping to send to college for the last 18 years, they will start thinking a bit more seriously. But don't just run up to Canada, folks, because the United States government has already made an agreement with Canada that Canada will extradite American citizens back to the United States to go serve in Iraq. So there are some serious things happening that, again, the mainstream press is not picking up. It will involve U.S. citizens and a number of people being sent to Iraq to be killed. This all gets back to money, though. We're trying to have a logical discussion about whether they're going to attack Iran or Syria or whomever. It's not logical. They will attack any place where they think they can have a nice, long, drawn-out war. In fact, in the Vietnam War, every time somebody had a report that was positive and that pointed to a way to win the conflict, it was stopped. The CIA would just get involved, and the war would go on, it would go on, it would go on. I'm going to tell you this, it's going to go on and on and on. They're going to make money and more money and more money. That's the whole plan to all of this.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think we've got to understand that the logic of this is not just the imperialist logic of taking resources. It's also an attempt to do what's called technically military Keynesianism. That is to say, the US government knows that the stock market is going to crash because there's a huge bubble, as we know, that which has been deflated. They know that the state has to intervene in the economy. Everybody knows that. It's only stupid ideologues like Margaret Thatcher who believe that the state doesn't intervene in the economy. The American imperialists are pragmatists. They know that the state has to intervene in the economy. In fact, it's quite logical and rational thing to do. And it was Roosevelt who pioneered the New Deal policy of state intervention in the economy. But, of course, Roosevelt intervened to create a welfare state. The problem with that is that the people of the United States might then get the idea that they were entitled to healthcare, to education, to opportunity. Where would it end? So they know they have to intervene in the economy, but they don't want to intervene to do anything constructive. They'd rather intervene for military purposes. And, of course, they own the companies which will sell the bombs to the government.
Well, yes, we're all making Bush very rich.
Now, we're coming up towards the end of the programme. I'd like my three guests to, in a way, sum up what they've been saying, but also to offer us some thoughts about whether there is light at the end of the tunnel, if this conflict does go on, as it seems it may do indefinitely. The war on terror is a war that many people say can't be won. Where is that light at the end of the tunnel?
I would see the role of Britain as being quite important in all of this. I mean, it's possibly because I'm British, but I think we've all been outlining the importance that Britain plays in the United States when we are the 53rd state. And if we're going to be the 53rd state, then we've got to start taking serious concern about US politics. For example, I don't see that it's at all unreasonable before the next election, possibly, if we can force it, or certainly immediately afterwards, that Britain should withdraw from Iraq. Why? What are we doing there? If the Americans want to fight there, let them go on. But there's no reason for us to be doing it. The Spanish drew that conclusion immediately. There's, you know, the Zapatero government was elected in a landslide and they pulled the troops out the next month.
Yeah, but with Jeff Hoon and Tony Blair, there's no real prospect of that happening, is there?
Well, we'll have to do something within the Labour Party then, or get rid of the Labour Party and vote somebody else in. The Liberals? I don't know. Plaid Cymru?
Chris Burns-Cox.
I think it's that one of the great problems about what's happened in our society is that the 99% of people don't know what's behind all these things. They know nothing of it, and they still believe that their politicians and their perhaps sometimes military or whatever it is, they believe that they're honourable people with honourable motives and their decisions are made for genuinely good reasons. We're brought up to think that, and we want to believe that desperately, and we can't quite, even those of us that are beginning to find out, we can't quite bear to believe the horror of what's happening. And I think that communication, gradually getting more on the internet, getting more young people getting on their computer and finding out, publicising these websites where the truth is actually there and where they can find it, I think that's probably the biggest thing we could do, because until the public and or a greater number of people in the United States and England, most of whom are wonderful people, it's only the certain people at the bottom, I would say, not the top, who are causing trouble. Until that majority gets to know more and understand more and realise the horror of what's happening, and it changes the teaching of history in books, teaching history in schools, etc., then I think it'll go from bad to worse. So I don't think there's a great deal of light at the end of the tunnel, other than through trying to get the public better informed about the horrors that we're enduring at the moment.
So if your young son and daughter is spending hours on the internet running up massive phone bills, there may be a positive side to it.
Can I mention just one website which I've found very useful over the last 3.5 years? It's a US website run by a guy called Mike Rivero, who used to be a Hollywood producer. He's actually a registered Republican, but it's still a very good website. It's called whatreallyhappened.com.
And what sort of website is that, Martin?
It puts up lots and lots of new information every day about all the things we've been talking about.
And there are a lot of organisations in the UK now, like Justice Not Vengeance and Voices in the Wilderness, etc. And if we could only get together more and form a bigger group, the trouble is when you put different pressure groups in one pot, they will want to explode and go back and be themselves. But I think somehow or other we've got to work together.
Well, there is a national alliance, isn't there, that organised the biggest demonstration this country's ever seen,
brilliant.
Between 2 and 3 million people in London, just before the outbreak of war. So are you saying that maybe that's not doing its job properly?
I would say that in Bristol, the Stop the War coalition has been very widely based, and we've all had to work together and accept that people have got different points of view. I think that's very important. There's going to be different points of view, but instead, I mean, we can all disagree, but we've all got to be united in our opposition to this barbarism.
Kenyon, your last comment.
I very much agree with both of them. Though let me end on maybe on a slightly more optimistic comment. I think that Britain can stop this. We're in the situation now where it's sort of like Neville Chamberlain is in office in one country and George W. Hitler is in office in another country. The British people have always been against oppression from the days of Boadicea to Churchill to the present. What's going on does not reflect the British people. The troops in Iraq are young men who have an honourable intention but are getting used by the politicians who are not honourable. I'm very optimistic, though, about Britain. I've come here of my own free choice. I love this country, and I'd just like to close tonight saying God bless the Queen. God bless the people of this country. May he send the troops back from Iraq, and may everybody here have this knowledge, this information.
Well, it's just coming up to 8 o'clock, and that's all for Dialogue this week. And this year, in fact, on Commonwealth FM, which will be going off the airwaves this Sunday evening. And if you're wondering why there was no one here defending US foreign policy, I can reassure you, it's not through want of trying. The US Embassy in London turned down our request for a speaker, but sent us a statement, which I read out earlier, essentially saying that they are bringing democracy to the world. I'm Tony Gosling. I'd like to thank my guests here in the Temple Mead studio. They have been Martin Summers from Bristol Stop the War, and ex-US Naval Intelligence veteran Kenyon Gibson, also a doctor of 30 years standing from French A Hospital, Chris Burns-Cox. And we have been discussing the new American empire. I'll be back one last time for the final edition of Dialect this Wednesday evening at 7 p.m, where we'll have the usual mix of local features, including a chat with the head of Bristol University's politics department. Bristol's Socialist Choir will be providing musical interludes, as will our very own lyrical commentator, Stanley Forbes. That's all at 7 o'clock this Wednesday evening here on Commonwealth FM. Dialect is a community radio project which I'm part of here in Bristol, so you can get involved too as a reporter or researcher, and you can contact us through Volunteering Bristol at 0117 989 7733 or pop into their Royal Oak House headquarters opposite Jury's Hotel near the Arnold Feeney.